This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheya Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The 3rd of October to the 5th of October, the protest is going on again because of Galamsey, which is a Ghanaian word, illegal mining. 60% of our water bodies in Ghana have been polluted by Galamsey.
That is reporter Prince Benjamin on advocacy groups in Ghana protesting the government's handling of illegal mining, which has wreaked environmental havoc across the country. Details coming up. Also, an agreement has been signed to resolve Libya's central bank crisis. And we speak with a Trump supporter and a Harris supporter from the African diaspora. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Demonstrators in Accra, who are part of the Democracy Hub advocacy group, are protesting the government's handling of Galamsey, illegal mining, which has wreaked environmental havoc across the West African country. I talked to our reporter Prince Benjamin, embedded with the protesters, for an update.
Yeah, he is. This is day one of the part two of the Say No to Galamsey demonstration. For this part two, the citizens and protesters are also asking that fellows who were arrested during the part one, which happened between the 21st and 23rd of September, and have been arrested and arraigned and have been remanded in police and prison custody, should be freed. Right now, we have done a walk from the Premier University of Ghana, which is called the University of Ghana. It's at Lagon. We started from there. It's supposed to be an 11.4-kilometer journey, and we're heading towards the Independence Square, that is also called the Black Star Square, in the heart of Accra.
Prince Benjamin, talk to us a little and explain to our listeners about this illegal mining, which has been a thorn on the side of successive Ghanaian governments, with the illicit activity contaminating rivers, destroying forests, and posing a grave threat to the country's environmental and public health. Talk to us a little about that.
Right, so Galamsey is at the heart of this demonstration. And today, from the 3rd of October to the 5th of October, the protest is going on again because of Galamsey, which is a Ghanaian word, illegal mining. 60% of our water bodies in Ghana have been polluted by Galamsey. The Ghana Water Company Limited has reported that, for example, in Cape Coast, which is the former capital of Ghana, their water supply challenges are going to increase. It's going to be a crisis if Galamsey is not checked. And since then, we've seen images of the local river in the central region, the Tano River. It doesn't look like a river, very much polluted. Looks like there is no life in it. I've also seen images of people who are fetching water, drinking, fetching water from this same source, which is polluted for farm activities. It's quite a horrible, horrible situation. Also, Joy News, a local news outlet in the country, has also, just yesterday, the 2nd of October, posted an infographics of 16 rivers in the country which have been affected by Galamsey. And this has been there, as you said, Yeseyas. It's been in the side, a thorn for our political leaders for decades.
And Benjamin, police have detained almost 54 protesters for what they describe as unlawful assembly. And there are reports of the police are kind of heavy-handed in handling the demonstrators.
Today being the 3rd of October, the very first day of the Free the Citizens and Say No to Galamsey protest. One thing that the protesters, the organizers of the protest, have said, and I've seen the Economic Fighters League, who are part of the organizers for this particular demonstration, they've commended the police several times during this protest, saying that this time around the handling of citizens and protesters has been incredible. They've done this commendation a couple of times, and they've been wondering what happened the last time. So this has been the contrast between the first demonstration that happened in September and this particular one. And again, I'm quoting the words of the organizers who have multiple times during today's demonstration, the first day of this part two, commended the police. So the police on this day have been very friendly in handling the demonstrators.
And lastly, Benjamin, how long will this protest continue, and how do you see it ending?
Okay, so the demonstration is going to end on the 3rd, this particular one. From the look of things, however, if the protesters who were arrested early on for the part one, if they're not released, I see more, you know, protests happening. So I can't really forecast and say definitively that this is going to be the end of it. However, this part two is a 3-day demonstration, just like the part one in September.
That was reporter Prince Benjamin in Accra. We spoke a few hours ago. The House of Representatives in Eastern Libya and High Council of State have signed an agreement to resolve the central bank crisis. The House voted unanimously to adopt the agreement following negotiations with the High Council under the auspices of the United Nations Support Mission in Libya, UNSMIL. Stephanie Corrie, acting head of UNSMIL, said the agreement highlights the ability of the Libyan parties to overcome challenges when the national spirit prevails and with the public's interest at the top priority. Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of Libya Analysis, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawi whether the agreement would contribute to stability in Libya.
It's important to say this is a very important agreement. Libya, for the last 5 weeks, has not been able to access any of the international systems or transactions. Prices are rising, economic things are getting much, much worse. So the fact they've been able to reach an agreement is very positive. That because the different sides have agreed to a new CBL governor who has just today been sworn in, that he should be able to take control of the central bank, resume a lot of these international transactions, and in theory, stabilize the situation. However, there's still a long way to go until that happens. That the first hurdle they've got to overcome is they've got to agree a board for the central bank within the next 2 weeks. I think we'll see quite a lot of political maneuvering around who gets appointed to that board. When the new governor then takes control of the bank, which it seems likely he will be able to do, he's still then got to deal with a huge amount of economic issues that were already in existence prior to the crisis of the last month, around lack of cash, low value of the dinar, huge public spending around other issues. And so I think that's going to be a big challenge. And against the backdrop of all of this, although the parties have agreed to this kind of consensus, it's really a kind of agreement of convenience and because there weren't many other options. So I think we're still going to see political maneuvering and different attempts to try and sway the influence of the new central bank. So I think it's overall positive. And then the next few weeks, we're going to see kind of how in reality this new board is able to function. Are they able to take the decisions that they need to, and will they be enforced effectively?
The acting head of the United Nations Support Mission in Libya, Stephanie Khoury, said the agreement highlights the ability of the Libyan parties to overcome challenges when the national spirit prevails and to put the interests of the Libyan people as a priority above all else. Does that mean the Libyan rivals can reach a political solution?
Unfortunately, I think the short answer to that is no. Now, that is because although they've reached agreement on this central bank issue, that was mainly because the Presidential Council and Prime Minister Dbeibah, who kind of initiated the crisis, were really put into a corner and didn't have many other options because they couldn't access these kind of international funds. On the political level, we still see that the Dbeibah government in Tripoli wants to retain power. We're seeing the authorities in eastern Libya would like to get rid of them. None of these status co-actors really want to lose their positions or power of influence, especially now they've kind of managed to access or, you know, kind of gain some control over the central bank through this agreement. I would also argue that it was not the interests of the Libyan people that kind of motivated this agreement. If it had been, they would have reached an agreement when it first started without letting the country get into such a dire economic state as it is now. Unfortunately, I think we're still seeing the kind of Libyan elites acting in their own self-interest, which is what we've seen for many years. And unfortunately, I don't see that that has actually fundamentally changed. So although there may be some momentum now for kind of UN-led dialogue, so we may see some more talks, I would be surprised if we saw a significant kind of progress on the political side in the coming weeks, although I hope I'm wrong about that.
So what's needed from the UN now to advance the long-awaited elections in Libya?
I think it is trying to take the momentum from the central bank agreement to bring the actors together. I think, to be honest, the main area that could make a difference, it will be around the economic side. If they can persuade or work with the actors to agree a unified budget, so some sort of mechanism whereby only the control of the central bank, but actually where the oil revenues, where this money is spent, that has been the main driver of political security conflict in Libya for many, many years. So I think if they can convert this central bank agreement into some sort of, you know, financial mechanism to oversee spending, that could provide a basis to reach some sort of political negotiation around that. But I think from the UN's perspective, it's trying to get them all in the same room and push those talks forwards.
That was Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of Libya Analysis, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. And we'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts about the news and our programs by WhatsApp. The number is +1 202 258 3076. Every Wednesdays, we'll be sharing our listeners' comments on Africa News Tonight. Both Democrats and Republicans in Ohio are hoping Tuesday's vice presidential debate will motivate people to participate in the coming election. VOA's Ken Farbo has more from Ohio.
Middletown is the hometown of U.S. Senator and vice presidential candidate J.D. Vance, a place he described in his book, Hillbilly Elegy, and where some of his supporters watched his debate with Minnesota Governor Tim Walz.
We feel like J.D. is very genuine because we know him. Somebody who's an everyday person.
Joe Statzer is executive director of the Republican Party in Butler County, Ohio, which includes Middletown.
In 2016 and 2020, Butler County led Ohio in plurality of votes for Donald Trump. It's conservative.
Statzer was pleased to hear Vance address the concerns most on his mind.
Like the border, like the economy. Those type of things, like the strike now that's going on in the East Coast.
Well, certainly people are concerned about cost of living. That's always important, and their health care.
Kathy Winant, chair of the Butler County Democratic Party, says reproductive rights and concerns about immigration were also focal points of the large debate watch party she hosted at a coffee shop in downtown Middletown.
As soon as J.D. Vance dehumanized human beings by calling them illegal aliens, it was a little frustrating to hear that kind of language.
I'm still concerned about immigration if Mr. J.D. Vance were to be the next vice president.
Jacob Payen is a member of the large Haitian community in Springfield, Ohio, about 60 kilometers from Middletown. Some in his community have been targeted since the presidential debate last month, when Republican nominee Donald Trump falsely claimed they are stealing and eating people's pets. What Payen looked for from Governor Walz was reassurance.
I need to be reassured that I'm going to be safe while I'm here in America, because we come to America to look for safety, for peace, for love. We come to America for all of that.
Payen believes he got some of that assurance.
Tonight, Tim Walz appeared to be more of a calm guy in the debate. Mr. Vance was more on the defensive mode.
My mind is made up.
Isaac Adi came to the United States more than 20 years ago from Nigeria and is a voter in Butler County. Despite rhetoric targeting Haitians in Springfield, Adi supports Trump and Vance's stance on immigration.
I came into this country legally, and I expect that everybody that is coming to this country should play by the rule, which is coming legally.
Democrats and Republicans seem to agree that the vice presidential debate won't change the outcome of the November election.
But what it does do is it lets people know how important it is that we all participate and that we get out and we vote.
Joe Statzer says the choice for Republicans isn't who to vote for, but when.
Just whether to vote for J.D. In advance or wait till Election Day.
Early voting in Ohio starts October 8th. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Middletown, Ohio.
Americans are getting ready to vote this fall in what promises to be very close presidential race. Like most Americans, members of the African diaspora community face a stark choice when deciding which direction the country should go. Joseph Swicord spoke with both a Trump and Harris supporter to get a sense of their very different experiences.
The Bon Sayum is a very industrious man.
We're going to leave it to run for a few minutes.
He works long hours running a small trucking company with three long-haul trucks.
Hey!
He came to the U.S. with his family to escape the war between Ethiopia and Eritrea in 2000.
You got a kill switch on this truck?
They forced people to leave their countries. And that caused a lot of problem for a lot of families at that moment. And a lot of families actually moved to the States.
Laban considers himself a fiscal and social conservative and is a big supporter of President Donald Trump.
When President Trump was in power, it was an amazing type of business. You know, the market was great. The job opportunities were great. And people were optimistic.
When it comes to his trucking business, Laban is feeling the pinch of high fuel prices. And that he blames on President Biden. He says during the Trump administration, fuel prices were in the $3 a gallon range.
Right now, unfortunately, with the gas prices, is hovering around $5 for the diesel, $4.50, $5 for the diesel. And as you know, transportation is the bloodline of the United States. Almost 70% of the goods are moved through trucks like this.
Global oil prices are extremely volatile and set by a complex set of factors. Laban insists former President Trump has the answer.
Trump showed us the way to do it. You drill, you drill, you drill, you drill, and then you compete. You see, now we don't need to explore other ideologies.
Democrats like Fatmata Berry see the choice in this election very differently. She came to the U.S. at the age of 11 from her native Sierra Leone. After law school, she settled in Montgomery County, Maryland, to pursue her passions, community advocacy and immigration law.
My dream would have been to have the kind of work where I can do the community work and still make a good enough living to live well.
Fatmata is a fierce advocate for civil rights, women's rights, and immigrants. She will be supporting Kamala Harris this November.
I think Vice President Kamala Harris is a person for the people. She is the person we need right now to bridge the divide that is in this country.
She is worried about Trump winning the presidency again.
The black community is being hurt more by the illegal aliens.
I am scared. The fear of immigrants is starting up again. The fear of black and brown people is starting up again. And it's hard when the person on top is leading it, so everyone else feels comfortable.
She says if the past is any guide, immigrants following the legal process will also be impacted by his plans to deport an estimated 11 million illegal migrants from the U.S.
And when they go for the interviews, they're doing it legally. They're detained and they're held. And some have been deported when they were not supposed to be deported.
Today, she is volunteering at a food bank.
Where do you want it?
She says although economic indicators are strong, there are many who are still falling between the cracks.
We look at the numbers, and the numbers look good, but there are people who are being missed, who we don't always think about, the hourly wage earners, the people who there are two, three families living in one home. The contrast basically is that the top 0.1% will have all the money and the rest of us will be struggling if you go with Trump. And the nation was never built like that. America became America because of the work that the blue-collar workers did in this country.
Two distinct visions for America, two distinct choices for the future. Jeff Swicord, VOA News, Silver Spring, Maryland.
At the UN General Assembly meeting in New York last month, African leaders posed for photos with Starlink owner Elon Musk and assured their citizens that cheaper, high-speed internet was coming to the continent. But in Zimbabwe, one of the countries that has licensed Starlink, some are concerned about the company's growing importance. Columbus Mavunga reports from the capital city, Harare.
Bus Stop TV is an online media house in Harare that has been using Starlink services since Zimbabwe licensed the satellite internet provider in early September. Panache Kaseke is a program assistant at Bus Stop TV.
We upload videos each and every day. The connection is faster and it's now easy for us. We are no longer facing challenges when uploading videos because comparing to other internet service providers, it used to be slow, but Starlink is fast. And also Starlink is affordable.
That reception among users is one reason why several African leaders met with Starlink owner and tech billionaire Elon Musk on the sidelines of the recent UN General Assembly last month. Some in Zimbabwe say the high-speed service will enhance connectivity in the country. William Shoko is an independent high-speed internet consultant.
There are opportunities in healthcare, education, agriculture, banking, and more. Zimbabwe has a wonderful opportunity to leverage connectivity for economic prosperity and progress.
Tatenda Mavetera, Zimbabwe's Minister of Information, Communication and Technology, says Starlink Zimbabwe is expected to expand internet access into remote areas with little or no service.
So for us, we believe that the coming of Starlink is going to make every organization is already in existence, coexist with what is there, and be able to make sure that we integrate with coming up with reliable and efficient connectivity.
But Tabani Moyo, Director of Media Institute of Southern Africa, is concerned about allowing a non-African company to play such a major role in Africa's connectivity.
Yeah, there's need for an African Union approach, wherein there's an agreement or no, certain levels of infrastructure it must bring to the continent. Rather than to have a domiciled technology that is based elsewhere, without remedies for the local users if they are switched off or if they face any forms of other challenges that are related to the use.
Meanwhile, Starlink is expanding across Africa since it first launched in Africa in January of 2023. The company has so far set up in more than a dozen African countries, ranging from populous nations like Nigeria and Kenya to smaller ones like Rwanda, Burundi, and Eswatini. Columbus Mavunga, VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
The British government today agreed to hand sovereignty of the Chagos Islands and the archipelago of more than 60 islands in the Indian Ocean to Mauritius. British Foreign Secretary David Lammy said the agreement will secure the future of a joint U.S.-British military base in Diego Garcia, the largest in the island chain of the tip of India. As part of the deal, the UK will retain sovereignty of Diego Garcia for an initial period of 99 years and will pay Mauritius an undisclosed rent. It will also create a resettlement fund for displaced Chagosians, aimed at by letting them move back to the islands other than Diego Garcia. The Chagos Islands were part of the British Indian Ocean Territory since 1965, when they were separated from the island nation Mauritius, a former British colony that gained independence in 1968. And Rwanda will start clinical trials of experimental vaccines and treatments for Marburg disease in the next few weeks, its health ministry said today. The country is fighting its first outbreak of the viral fever, which has so far killed 11 people. The disease was detected in late September, with 36 cases reported so far. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.